Good afternoon. The title of this afternoon's plenary session is Learning in Israel, Pitfalls, Perspectives, and Solutions for Parents, Rabbis, Synagogues, and Yeshivot. And I think probably presumed here in the title is that there are many wonderful things that come out of the process of learning in Eretz Yisrael, and there's recognition here as well that there are many issues and challenges that arise both before and after, and that those are primarily what we are here to address. I think not only because this is a subject that's near and dear to my heart, but also objectively speaking, that this afternoon's subject is one of the most important issues presently facing our community and our communities. When we think as Rabbanim, whether as shul rabbis, as educators, about what our primary goals are as Rabbanim, I think things that come to mind are increasing in our communities, frumkeit, Torah learning, halachic observance, tightening the relationship of our communities to Israel, working on the development of children in our communities, and also helping to resolve conflicts, and particularly family conflicts within our communities. When we think about the experience of the year in Israel, both leading up to and following the year in Israel, each and every one of these critical aspects of our Rabbanus are really tied in with issues that come in some shape or form out of the year in Israel experience. Also, I believe that we as Rabbanim, much more than people in the community often realize, are really in the thick of things when it comes to the year in Israel experience. Whether it's as a mediator, mediating between parents and their children who've returned from yeshiva in Israel, mediating between parents in our community who are checking their mezuzahs to figure out where they went wrong, and the Israeli yeshivas that they have certain issues with, or the American schools that sent their children to those Israeli yeshivas. And also, and I think perhaps in some ways most importantly, mediating between the students who have returned and our shuls and our communities, and helping both those students figure out how it is, in what way, because research demonstrates that they have not finished their process of change when they return. How can we help them meld back into the community, and how can we help the community help them do so and accept them when they return, even if they've changed in the process? We also have our own personal issues surrounding the year in Israel and the those who return. How does it affect us personally based on whether we've been there personally and had such an experience or not had such an experience? How does it affect us when those who have returned, whom we influenced, perhaps, for 18 years, are not going to have us as a Masada Kedushin at their wedding, but someone else, are not going to ask us, perhaps, the Shilas, although they now ask many Shilas, but maybe asking someone else those Shilas? And to think about all these issues, and finally, before we get started with our panel today, I think it's helpful to put into historical perspective what we're really talking about. People here know, and many know better than I, about how the process began, how the phenomenon began of the year in Israel, going back good 40 plus years in Israel, and how it's picked up steam over the last 20, 25 years in particular. And we owe a debt of gratitude to those Rabbanim, both here in America and also in Israel, who have helped the year in Israel become a built-in part of the experience of the children in our community. At the same time, I think we've reached a point where we don't just have the year in Israel experience, but we've actually started to step back and analyze that year in Israel experience and try to figure out what is it that works, what is it that's good, and what is it that needs to be changed, improved, talked about, thought through as regards the year in Israel. And this is a process that's begun relatively recently. In the 1990s, really educators began thinking about this issue. Rabbi Shalom Berger wrote a doctoral dissertation on the subject. The journal, the educators' journal, Ten Dot, has had articles on the subject throughout the 1990s. And more recently, communal organizations, the Orthodox Caucus, spearheaded first by Rabbi Herring, now by Rabbi Josh Joseph, have really raised many issues surrounding the year in Israel and have a website that addresses many of the issues surrounding the year in Israel. And now, here today, I think it's a milestone at our RCA convention for us to be meeting together, putting these issues out, thinking them through together. And my hope and tefillah and hope for the committee for next year is that this will not simply be a single session that happened to take place one year at the RCA, but rather will become one of the cornerstones of the discussion at upcoming RCA conventions as well. We're fortunate here today to have on our panel people who will be speaking to us from very different perspectives, speaking to us from the perspective of the American educator, the Israeli educator, and from the perspective of Talmud, who's gone through the experience personally. Many of you know the Rabbanim who are here on the panel. Rabbi Moshe Sefsky and Rabbi Meir Schiller have been influencing Talmidim hundreds, if not thousands, over decades. Rabbi Sefsky, Rosh Yeshiva or Yerushalayim, has been editor of Jewish Thought Journal, also has his doctorate from Furkauf of Yeshiva University. Rabbi Meir Schiller, Rabbi at MTA, is known for the articles, books he's published, as well as the speaking that he's done around the world surrounding issues of Jewish religious and philosophical issues. Our final speaker today, who has all that fame of his career yet ahead of him, is a smicha student, a person who has had the privilege of learning with both Rabbi Schiller and Rabbi Sefsky. Saria Malitsky is in smicha now, went through his own process, and will share some of his thoughts from the perspective of a Talmud not so long ago, about the experience. The format for today's session: each speaker has been allotted 15 to 20 minutes to speak. That will hopefully leave us a good amount of time as well for question and answer session at the end. Please, before we begin, if everybody can make sure that their cell phones are off or on vibrate. And finally, you have your yellow pads. As in the previous session, we'll just ask of you to please write down any questions as we go along on the yellow paper that you have. You can hand those either directly to me or to Rabbi Bixen, and I will then, at the end, communicate those questions. Please write, in addition to your question, the name of the individual to whom you're addressing the question. We'll begin with the pre-Israel experience. Rabbi Schiller, who's a Rebbe in MTA, without further ado, Rabbi Schiller.
Twenty-seven years ago, when I entered the field of modern Orthodox Yeshiva High School education at the then Yeshiva High School of Queens, my principal, Rabbi David Cohn, called me aside, since he had given me the task of teaching some of the more difficult seniors in the school, and he said, "You know what your job is." And I said, "Well, what is my job?" "Your job is to get them to Israel." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because that's where it all happens." And I was wet behind the ears, just having emerged from a kollel experience in the Hasidic kollel, and I had no idea what he was talking about at the time. And I rapidly learned. In future years, I learned that my former Talmidim, when they would return before Pesach after half a year in Eretz Yisrael, those very Talmidim that had had difficulty calling me Rabbi in their senior year were now calling me Rebbe, or perhaps in more exotic cases, the Rebbe, when they would converse with me after 6 months in Eretz Yisrael. I was also on alert to the fact that I had to always try to make my own Shmon Esrei's at Mincha a little bit longer, because the Talmidim that had returned from Eretz Yisrael would inevitably be davening the painfully long Shmon Esrei's Pesach time, and I didn't want to look absolutely foolish in their eyes. Nonetheless, despite these ironic and whimsical tales that we can all tell about the rapid turnover, the rapid born-again process of those who go to Eretz Yisrael to learn, I can report as an introductory remark that this is a uniformly positive experience for the most part. In other words, the vast majority of Talmidim and the vast majority of instances benefit enormously by having spent a year in Eretz Yisrael. And in fact, I believe that the army of Talmidim that have returned from Eretz Yisrael have played a very large role in creating a Torah renaissance particularly in the modern Orthodox community, which I wrote about a few issues back in Jewish Action. There is no comparison between the parents and Talmidim that I deal with today in MTA and those that I dealt with 2.5 decades ago. Standards of learning are improved, standards of shmiras and mitzvahs are improved, general orientation towards Judaism, towards Klal Yisrael, towards Israel, towards Yiddishkeit, everything is better. Nonetheless, there is a little sense of misgiving that we all have, and I'd like to address some of those misgivings. In fact, there is a very popular fictional work that has just appeared that attempts to address some of these issues. Tova Mervis has followed up her original attack on mainstream Memphis Orthodoxy in the name of Karl Bakke and freedom. She's followed up her first book with a second book, which is in seemingly a critique of what she would describe as religious extremism in the name of Chabura, pluralism. But this fictional account of those that are born again, so to speak, in Eretz Yisrael does not address, at least in my opinion, the depth of the issues that we have before us. Now, what are some of those issues? The first I'm going to mention very quickly and return to it at the end. And that is, if our Talmidim Talmidos experience an abrupt rupture of their prior lifestyle in Eretz Yisrael, then that says something very distressing about the chinuch process that they receive in America up until they go to Eretz Yisrael. And in fact, I think it condemns, to a large extent, myself and my fellow educators. It suggests that we have not been really equal to the task of producing generations of B'nai Torah with Yerushalayim up until the point when they depart for Eretz Yisrael. Now, I'll get back to that a little later on in my discussion, but that, I think, is the first subject that has to hit us squarely between the eyes. That is, what does, if in fact entry into a Torah-learning, Shmiras HaMitzvah environment is so disconcerting to our children, then what does that say about what we've done up until Eretz Yisrael? Now, I'm going to present two sets of misgivings about the Israel process. One of them, I think, is not legitimate, and one which I think is. The first set of misgivings I will label the Jewish week's fear of the turn to the right. And there's a constant theme, especially in popular Jewish journalism, that the movement known as modern Orthodoxy, open Orthodoxy, centrist Orthodoxy, whatever you want to call it, Torah and Derech Eretz, Torah Mada, is experiencing a frightening turn to the right. And again, one who reads dutifully the pages of the Jewish Week or the Forward is constantly encountering this phrase. And I think that when we subject this phrase to any degree of serious analysis, that it seems not to be quite what it's made out to be. Wherein lies the turn to the right? If turn to the right would mean, let us say, perhaps a rejection of political Zionism in the name of non- or anti-Zionism, then clearly the experience in Eretz Yisrael, as has been documented in various studies, actually reinforces those allegiances and does not undercut them. So that clearly cannot be what we're talking about. If turn to the right means a rejection of secular studies, rejection of a college education, obviously there are some situations where that might be what takes place, but by and large it is not. By and large, the boys and girls return, continue with college educations, postgraduate educations. There seems to be no rupture there. I do add, though, that perhaps one might argue that the fear is that secular studies are being pursued for pragmatic reasons and not lishma, but I don't know if we can say that Eretz Yisrael is a factor there so much as the general consumerist and careerist reductionism of society, which no longer sees the pursuit of the liberal arts as a means of uplifting the soul of man, but sees it as a means to earn a living. So it's not necessarily, I don't think in any way, the Eretz Yisrael experience which does this. But a practical pursuit of secular studies certainly remains unharmed. Another area which is sometimes bandied about is that of tolerance, that boys, girls return from Eretz Yisrael, and they're no longer tolerant. Tolerance, pluralism, is a very complex topic, and it's not our place this afternoon to discuss the various different philosophical apprehensions of what tolerism and pluralism could possibly mean. Obviously, some of them verge and go beyond the confines of the truth commitment that any normative faith, and certainly Torah, must have. There must be an assent to truth, there must be an assent to absolutes, to value, to certain realities about history. And this form of tolerance, which says that there are no such absolutes, is a tolerance that has to be condemned by any Orthodox faith, and of course by our own Orthodox faith as well. So if the definition of tolerance and of pluralism that is lost in Eretz Yisrael, if it is the sort of superficial Western European, North American commitment to all questions being forever open questions, then perhaps the experience does expand the young boys, the young girls' apprehension beyond the confines of that subjectivist theoretical ghetto. But certainly I don't think any Orthodox thinkers or religious people could bemoan that if that is what we mean. There is another possible understanding of what is lost in terms of tolerance, but I'll get to that in my legitimate critique, which I'll present to you in a few moments. There are two other areas where one could bemoan the Eretz Yisrael experience. Those are in relations to issues that have of late begun to prick the conscience of the so-called modern Orthodox community, and that those issues are those that relate to the non-Jew and to women. And there is a agonizing set of problems that goes along with the reading and understanding of our sacred texts and the sensibility and the consciousness of modern enlightenment, post-enlightenment European society, European culture. And this is in fact a very real problem, and perhaps the problem is exacerbated by the experience in Eretz Yisrael, perhaps not. But I'll return to that when we get to the area of legitimate critique, because I think those two areas do fit into that of legitimate critique. Now, by legitimate critique, what are we referring to? We all have an impulse, which is not too clearly defined, that what happens in Eretz Yisrael sometimes happens too fast. It supplies answers that are not adequately understood. It caters to a certain sense of everybody when they're 18, 19, 20, 21 to want to have all the answers, to want to have all the answers in the face of and against community, parents, etc. And we have a sense that there are some negative ways in which the Israeli experience plugs into this. They manifest themselves in several areas. One of which I would say is the approach to what I would define as the non-explicitly sacred. In other words, it is not only that many young people return from Eretz Yisrael with a stronger sense of assent to Torah and Tefillin, Emunah, and the basics of Torah mitzvahs, but they return with a puritanical worldview which sees two sets of experiences in life: the explicitly sacred Torah, Tefillah, Chesed, etc., and the not good, which includes both that which is explicitly sinful along with that which I define as the non-explicitly sacred. And herein, I think, lies a serious critique of the experience, and in fact is part of what creates the problem, or a lot of the problems, in terms of adjustment once the young people return to America. They have no place to categorize a whole cartload of experiences which may have moved them before Eretz Yisrael, which are not in and of themselves averas, but do not seem to fit into the first parak of Mesillas Yesharim, which has so inflamed their neshamas in Eretz Yisrael. These experiences do not seem to fit in. So the first problem, I think, would be the problem of the categorization of the non-explicitly sacred, which, again, undermines tremendously in the minds of young people and puts out of balance a lot of their own life's experiences, home experiences, experiences with parents. They don't know where to file all these things. They don't know where to file lots of popular culture. They don't know where to file general knowledge. They don't know where to file happy experiences in life that are not explicitly sacred. So I think this is one of the real problems. The next area is what I would define in general as the area of mercy and love. And I prefer those two terms to the terms of pluralism and tolerance. Pluralism and tolerance are terms that seem to partake very much of the cliches and rhetoric of modernism. Love and mercy are traditional Torah terms. And I think that what is sometimes lost in the Eretz Yisrael experience is the recognition of what the New England Primer said, and in Adam's fall, we sinned all. And I don't mean to get into a theological discussion of to what extent that's true, but I just mean to say there seems to be a lack of understanding of the human weakness that plagues each and every one of us. And that sometimes a boy comes back or a girl comes back from Eretz Yisrael, and they're very, very judgmental in a way which caters to the worst in midos. It's an angry judgmentality. It's a bitter way of judging others. It feeds into the worst of midos ra'os. And what the antidote to that, as I see it, and the proper critique of that, comes not from the rhetoric of the modern world with its assertion of pluralism and tolerance, but comes from the rhetoric of various sources in our own tradition, whether the Hasidic sources of love for the weak and in Reb Zishin, Reb Levi Yitzchak of Berditcheva, and Reb Moshe Leib Sasseva, and continuing to our own day with, let's say, the Belz Rav Zichron Levracha, Lubavitcher Rebbe. There are these sources in the Hasidic tradition. Obviously, Rav Kook is also a great source for this, but the source of loving and understanding the weaknesses of the human condition, and I would just toss out very, very briefly, throw out one sentence here and dangle it, that I believe very strongly, along with Rabban Lichtenstein here, that literature is a very effective means to understand the complexity and the plenitude of the human experience, and does not allow us to make simplistic judgments. But that's a subject for a different time and a different place. As far as Zionism is concerned, there is, I believe, a legitimate critique that can be made of the Israel experience. And here I don't mean to prejudge for the purposes of this talk. I obviously we all make judgments of our own, but it's not relevant to this talk. There are various strains of Zionist thought. We're all aware of that. Zionism is a universe of vastly diverse ways of viewing the world, viewing the purpose of the Jewish people, viewing the role of the Gentile. There is one particular strain of Zionism which, again, and here, this is not meant judgmentally at this point, there is one particular strain of Zionism which we'd sort of call, I think, the Jabotinsky, Lechi, Etzel, Likud, Sharon, and Points Right approach to Zionism. And I think that by and large, the Israeli religious yeshivas, religious Zionist yeshivas, are plugged into this particular strain of Zionism. There are other more humanistic strains of Zionism, of religious Zionism, which I think that our young people are not exposed to. They're not exposed to in Eretz Yisrael. They're not exposed to here in America before they go to Eretz Yisrael. As far as the issues in terms of women and the non-Jew, I think that what we have here is a big problem, not only because of Eretz Yisrael, or not solely because of Eretz Yisrael. We have a problem in terms of modern egalitarian consciousness, modern universal justice, universal morality, and many, many things in our own tradition. And anybody that is capable of going to sleep at night soundly with these problems in their belly is probably has a lack of sensitivity either to our own tradition or to the claims of morality as they rest upon modern men. So I don't think their Israel experience necessarily hurts that, except in terms of the right-wing Zionism. The last thing which I'm going to return to, as time is short, the last thing we're going to return to here is the implicit critique of what we do in our high schools up until Eretz Yisrael, which results from the successes that they achieve. This is an extraordinarily powerful point, and until we find people who are capable of the passion, commitment, along with understanding and love, to staff our high schools, Rebbeim and Rosh Yeshivas and principals and Menahalim, and in the field is a field which is very, very easily capable of beating down the most idealistic of people, and it seems to me sometimes the higher one goes in the field, the more one is beaten down in terms of idealism. But there is a tremendous need to create this cadre of those who are both passionately pious as well as understanding and full of mercy and love. Again, a complex task, but that's the beginning of how we should address it in terms of America. And I think those are the terms we should all relate to when we talk about the Eretz Yisrael phenomena. It is how we are to balance the passions of piety, as evidenced in greater commitment to emuna, to kedusha, to tahara, to bitachon, to learning, to davening, to shmiras mitzvahs, how we balance that with a proper understanding of the complexity of the human situation, as well as love for all of Klal Yisrael and all of humanity. And that balancing act is both a balancing act which we must do in terms of our students returning from Eretz Yisrael, but it's also the balancing act which is the task of each and every Jew. And may the Ribbono Shel Olam help us to succeed in that task.
Rabbi Shostovsky.
Rabbi Shlomo, the first speaker placed an emphasis on some very, very crucial and important points, which I will also address. But while he, you know, took the liberty to emphasize the philosophical perspective of the year in Israel, I would like to emphasize more on the process and more on the practical dimension of what takes place. Also the critique of what took place prior, what takes place after they leave Israel. And since this is a rabbinical council, I believe that my task should be identifying trends and perhaps, you know, giving some little pointers of where the Rav could fit into the process. The first thing I would like to say is that it's very obvious, and I don't think I'm in the least bit big mechadish anything, to say that a profound change does take place as part of the Israeli experience. And to my mind, the primary reason for that is the following. In terms of Jewish education, the average parent spends probably somewhere between $120,000 to $180,000 if their child has gone from first grade, you know, through high school on Jewish education. And the real truth is that there's a lot, obviously, good that takes place, you know, as part of the process. But the question is, in the final analysis, have we fallen short? And there are exceptions, and I have to say most of the exceptions to what I'm about to say is really in the metropolitan New York area, some of the larger cities where they have large schools and are able to have an honors class, and therefore they're able to give a decently comprehensive Jewish education where the student walks away with a decent level of skills and a decent level of knowledge. Or even though in the best of high schools we've found in giving interviews that the skills are very, very lacking. As the average boy who's interviewed, even if he's a very, very excellent student, like really is not very good at being able to prepare a piece of Gemara, even if he enjoys Gemara and has learned it for quite a long time. The greater problem is in smaller schools and in schools that the Gemara curriculum or that the Talmud curriculum or that the Limudei Kodesh curriculum is a relatively undeveloped one. And that's undeveloped sometimes because of the emphasis on, you know, excellence in secular studies, which obviously we're interested in. But sometimes it's simply a result of the fact that many schools around America are small and you can't generate an honors class. And therefore you may have like 12 seniors. Obviously I'm talking more in terms of the boys' experience because that's, you know, where my knowledge is from. But in any case, you're talking about maybe 10, 12, 15 students in a class, students on various levels. And therefore, you can't really generate a very, very strong program. And the end result of that is that very, very often in the average high school, the student is learning approximately 6 to 10 blot a year. Right? Not in the difficult mesechtes of Nashim Nezikin. Sometimes they're forced to create a curriculum where the study of Gemara is topical, and therefore a student walks in with not very, very much in the way of skills. And when he finishes 4 years, basically what he's learned is some 25 to 40 blot out of a shas that comprises over 2,500 dafim. And I believe, and somebody once commented, that there's a lot of truth to the fact that sometimes they learn just enough to decide that they don't like it. And that's a real problem. And what happens in the process in Eretz Yisrael, you know, they come in a little bit skeptical whether they can handle a full day of learning, whether they can handle as much Gemara as is thrown at them. But at the end of the process, in the average yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, they've studied some 20 or so dapim and bi'iyun, and iyun means with a lot, with much preparation time, where there's development on the thought processes, developing their thought processes, developing their skills. But even more important, in most yeshivas, I know that it's certainly true about our yeshiva, they have a night seder or an afternoon seder that consists of bikiyut. And bikiyut means that in addition to 20 blat that they're learning bi'iyun, they're studying, at least in our case, approximately 80 additional dapim, and basically finish the mesechet that they're studying between the morning seder and the evening seder. There's built-in chazara, and therefore they really get to know it. And as much as they like the iyun, what I find is whenever we give them some free time, basically what they're undertaking is to study the chazara of the bikiyas. Because after a month, all of a sudden, they've learned 30 blot in bikiyas. After 2 months, 30 blot. After a few months, 50 blot. And then they finish a mesechet like Bava Kama. When they come back a second year, they're finishing another mesechet like Kiddushin. And for the first time in their lives, they really say, hey, if I can do Kiddushin and I can do Bava Kama, like, what in the world can I not do? And therefore, it just opens up their horizons in terms of learning and gives them a tremendous, tremendous drive, like anybody else in any field. If we're successful at it and we feel our skills developing and all of a sudden we begin to like it, that obviously is a tremendously, tremendously profound change, where they basically did not like Gemara study before, or the Mudit Kodesh studies before, like they develop a passion for it. And that has obviously a lot of positive consequences, as Rabbi Schiller said. I think it's predominantly positive, but also some negative as well. In addition to that, the curriculum of the average yeshiva high school is such that when they come into Eretz Yisrael, they, for some reason, do not know well, like halacha, even basic halacha and orechayim, of hilchas tefillah, of hilchas brachot, and therefore there's a tendency not to take davening all that seriously, not to be medaktik in brachas, etc. And one of the things that they do in Israel is, you know, they usually have a halacha seder, and in our case, we have a Rosh Kollel, who's a very excellent posek, and they have an opportunity to ask shailas, and therefore they begin taking the process of tefillah and the process of making of diktuk and mitzvahs quite seriously. And that obviously, more than anything else, I just find that the learning process that takes place in Israel is really what causes a profound, profound, and very dramatic change in an 18-year-old personality. Like Rabbi Schiller spoke about some of the pitfalls of an 18-year-old being all of a sudden transformed. But I really believe that one of the great problems that exist is what Rabbi Schiller started out his talk with. I've spoken to many principals. And the basic feeling is that what the yeshiva high school experience is about, especially in the 11th and 12th grade, is getting them to Eretz Yisrael. And I think that's a very, very big mistake, because the yeshiva is really meant to educate. And the more we would educate in high school, and the more we would think through the process of what should be on the curriculum, what is significant or what is not significant, what type of knowledge they should have, and what type of skills they should develop. And 12 years of Jewish education is certainly long enough to be able to develop that process. Then the Israel experience would be an enhancing one rather than one that transforms. And all in all, I think it's really perhaps much more what we would want as part of the process. But be it as it may, There's no question that the Israeli experience is one that totally transforms, like, the Syrian student who benefited from the process. And as we said before, in many, many ways, very positively, a passion for learning, a passion for Diktukah Mitzvahs, obviously development of a love for Eretz Yisrael. And these are the positive things, but there are also some of the pitfalls that Rabbi Schiller had pointed out as well. So the first advice or that I would like to give is that we really have to think through the process of 12 years of education prior to Israel. And the students should come with enough skills and enough knowledge that Israel would be very, very important and the first time that he can really sit and learn, you know, to the degree that he can with Hasmada, but that it wouldn't be a totally transforming process. Israel also has other effects because it really takes the student away from his environment. It takes him away from the mass media. You know, he may occasionally go to a movie on a Matzah Shabbos, but not the same level of involvement as he had before. In some instances, there's more of an emphasis in Israel on participatory sports, but not so much, you know, sitting there and watching the doubleheader or a football doubleheader on a Sunday afternoon. And this really creates a certain environment that allows the student to really think through the certain things that he thought were significant to him. He finds that just not as important as he thought that they would be. Also in Israel, every yeshiva takes their students on Shabbatonim to various places to meet various personalities. Almost every yeshiva has a Shabbos in Bnei Brak and some other places. And for the first time, they're exposed to people who they feel, you know, rightfully or not, but in most cases that happens to be the case, that exude what they would call a certain feeling of Kedusha. And when they go to the Kotel, they sense that an overwhelming sense of Kedusha. Every yeshiva goes to Sfat, and there's something mystical about that city that also opens up like certain feelings that they never had before. And therefore, like that also, you know, gives them a type of feeling that they really feel that, you know, they're different and their values, they start rethinking things, like really what is important to me and what is not important to me. And one of the things that actually happens is, I know that this year and most years, we take the yeshiva to Beit El. Now, Beit El is a Umi community. But when you go to Beit El, you see that you walk into a shul and there's absolutely no talking. And Balabatim do serious learning in that community. And it's an incredible Torah community. And for the first time, they realize that it has not that much to do with, you know, with right-wing orthodoxy versus centrist orthodoxy. But somehow they sense that in Eretz Yisrael, like, things are taken, you know, more seriously in the realm of Kedusha than what they were used to. And this also is something that has a tremendous, tremendous effect. In fact, what they normally find predominantly is that people's identification of almost more, most of the people and most of the communities that they meet is much more so in terms of their spirituality than in terms of their professional identity. And that is something that they're not so used to when in America, when they come back to America. And therefore, these are difficulties that they deal with when they come back. And a 17, 18-year-old is not necessarily the person who is most capable of dealing with these issues. I think it's very important when they come back for the Rav to realize this, that when they come back with a certain passion, they come back with a certain identity for themselves, that they're people who really want to be in an environment where they can grow religiously, grow spiritually, grow in Torah, and that has to be provided. And the real truth is that shuls that have jumped on that bandwagon, I think one particular shul that I, in a modern Orthodox community that I'm thinking of, started a ninth kollel, and post Israel students like flock to that shul. There must be at least 20 or so graduates of our yeshiva that are members of that shul. And if the Rav gets them involved in giving shiurim, and giving little talks, being involved with youth groups. I think this is also something that they're looking for in their shul. But if that's not going to be part of the process of their return, and we're going to expect them to fit right in, it just simply won't happen. As they're looking for something a little bit more, they're looking for an environment where they can daven seriously, they're looking for an environment where they can really concentrate much more on their spiritual side of them. And I think it's a relatively easy task for the shul rabbi to be cognizant of that and to be accommodating in that realm. But if we won't be, we're not going to actually find that they're responsive, you know, to the rav and to the shul, which obviously is one of the issues that we're talking about. There are a number of trends that I would like to identify that I think are taking place and that the rav, the American rabbi, has to be aware of. Right now, let's start, I think 15 years ago, the average parent sending their son to Israel, or daughter, I'm speaking in terms of a boy's yeshiva, like basically sent them because it was becoming a little bit of a trend and the kid wanted to go, but basically the feeling was like, well, okay, you'll have a year in Israel, but then you got to get on with life. That is not quite the case today. I think that today the average parent like is really looks forward in a certain sense to a son going and studying in Eretz Yisrael. I think that the process of Eretz Yisrael has developed a much greater respect for Torah in the modern Orthodox community, and parents are truly proud, you know, of their student, of their sons going and studying and doing well and developing a love for learning. On the other hand, you know, it's very, very important that the schools in Israel like realize that that comes along with a certain responsibility. At 18 years old, it's not a time that people can make lifelong decisions, and therefore it's extremely important that they be directed towards going back, pursuing their careers, and at that point, you know, having the various options open to them, like once they have the degrees, if they want to go into chinuch, if they wanted to go rabbanis, or they want to pursue careers in other fields. There's one other major trend that has to be identified is the amount of aliyah that is beginning to take place for students studying in Eretz Yisrael. And I think part of that is due to the fact that already a certain percentage of parents are parents who themselves studied in Eretz Yisrael. Years ago, a parent was objected very, very strongly and greatly to a child who wanted to make aliyah. Because the parents themselves had studied in Eretz Yisrael, that has changed dramatically. They're very proud of the fact that the kids want to go to Eretz Yisrael. I know that we have some 70 alumni presently residing there in Eretz Yisrael. Now, Rabbi Galinsky has mentioned to me, and I'm sure it's true about other yeshivas as well, that there's a very, very startlingly large percentage of students in his Mossad, in his institution, that are now making aliyah. And in fact, for the first time, it's actually spoken of publicly. There's an organization, Alon Aleh, that organizes the 800-900 students studying in Israel for an Israel night, which talks about aliyah. There's another more practical night that takes place with booths of people studying or are in Israel that talk about, you know, the process, what it would take for you to be successful in a particular career and coming into Eretz Yisrael. I think that's also something that the American rabbinate has to be cognizant of. And Israel has changed very dramatically, and I'll just finish up that I remember 24 years ago when we went on Aliyah, we made a little house sale in our backyard. And there's this woman who came along, and she bought like $4.30 worth of goodies at the house sale and gave us a $5 bill. And as we were about to give change, you know, she asked, oh, by the way, where are you going? So we said, we're going to Israel. So she said, Israel? Oh, keep the change. I think that that's changed very dramatically. There are communities that sort of cater for an American coming to Israel. And in general, it's a very Western type of society that American feels very comfortable in. And I think that's also a trend that the American rabbinate has to be very cognizant of, how he wants to deal with it or how he should deal with it. I'm not providing the solutions, but I'm trying to identify some of the things that have taken place in the process of a year in Israel.
Our last speaker, Sariel Maletsky. While Sariel is speaking, people can feel free to write their questions on the yellow pad, again addressed to a particular speaker, and then right after he finishes, you can pass those up. Thank you.
Growing up as a congregant in both of our Przanski's two shuls in Queens and Teaneck, and then being a Talmud in Rabbi Shiller Shir in high school, and then as a Talmud in Rabbi Sosevsky's yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, it never entered my mind that I'd ever be speaking in front of the three of them at the same time. I'd like to thank Rabbi Przanski for giving me the opportunity to speak in their presence and really in the presence of so many Rabbanim Chashuvim. I think I'd start with a little background information about myself to put my perspectives into context. As I mentioned, I grew up in Queens and then in Teaneck as a congregant at Przanski Shuls. I went to MTA for high school and followed with a year and a half of learning in Eretz Yisrael in Or Yerushalayim, or OJ as it's come to be known. Since I graduated from YU, and now I'm learning in REITs and pursuing a master's degree in education from Azrieli. I've also had a lot of interaction with kids throughout the years. I've participated in numerous informal chinuch programs. I've been involved in YU, Kolim, in cities such as Denver, where Rabbi Alter is here, and Rabbi Cohn as well, and in Orlando. Soil. So there are two methods he can employ to meet that end. A person could take the cup and pour it upside down, spill the oil out. Or a person could take water and pour water into the cup. And if he pours enough water into the cup, so mamela, all the oil will spill out. And I think in trying to reach children, the latter method is too often ignored. Kids are constantly told why they can't do things, and how this is usur and this is wrong, but how often are they told why they should do mitzvos? We're using damage control methods as opposed to preventative measures. Now, obviously, the taivas today are stronger, more common, and more accessible than ever before. And trying to simulate the Israel experience is hard in America just by virtue of the fact that Israel is physically distanced from many of these taivas. However, I do believe that there is a lot that can be done in America, and specifically by shul rabbis. Again, kids are always told why they can't and why they shouldn't do things. Kids are not exposed to the fact that Pikudei Hashem Yisharim Misam Chelev and Kilekach Tov Nasati Lachem. Kids today have so many questions, and unfortunately, they don't feel that they have someone to speak to and to find answers. Kids question God's role in tragedy. Kids don't understand tefillah. They'll ask, why do we have to say paragraph upon paragraph of tefillah that was written thousands of years ago by some rabbi? Why can't we thank God for what we want when we want? Why can't I ask God for what I want when I want? Tefillin is annoying for kids. Tefillin, the association they have with tefillin is the rabbi in school saying, don't take off your tefillin till the last amen, after the last kaddish, after shul shel yom. Kids are never exposed to the fact that tefillin is called a pe'er. Or any mitzvah. It's always negative. Shabbos is about the lamentes melachos, and you can't watch TV or play ball on Shabbos. But they're not exposed to the beauty of Shabbos. Now Shabbos is main olam haba. Kids want to know why they can't chew non-kosher gum. There's no pig in gum. Or why shouldn't they smoke or do drugs or drink? They want to know what's the Torah's view on relationship with girls. And these are the issues that kids need and want to hear about. And they have these questions, but they don't feel that they have someone to speak to. And I think in Eretz Yisrael, so they have the Rebbeim who initiate conversation and discussions on these issues. And even if the issues weren't initiated, so they feel comfortable enough to speak to the Rebbeim. And I think as shul rabbis, they're invaluable opportunities to discuss these issues. Last week, I was in Teaneck for Shavuos, and I learned with a few of the 7th grade boys whom I developed a great relationship with from my hockey league. And when I asked them what they had been learning prior to our Chavrusa, they told me that their Rebbe, a 7th grade Rebbe, gave a shiur on the Torah's view on smoking. Now the Rebbe didn't wait for them to start smoking, and then gave a shiur on the dangers of smoking. In seventh grade, where they're most impressionable, the Rebbe was able to pick a topic that was what they want, of interest to them, and more importantly, what is important for them to hear about. As a rabbi, there could be question and answers or forums or really informal discussions where they're at the house and speaking to the Rebbe about these issues. And if they don't bring it up, so the rabbi can bring up these issues to engage them, to discuss with them, to get them to talk about these issues. Flyers being put up is probably not the optimal choice. Really, the kids should be themselves be called about these issues. And that's really the first idea, is that kids have these questions and these problems and these doubts, but without anyone addressing them. And the question is, though, how do we create an atmosphere where kids want to speak to their rabbi about these issues? So I know for myself, when I went to Eretz Yisrael, so I experienced something that I never experienced in all my years of yeshiva education. And the second day I was in yeshiva, it was the first time I was in Israel, and it was hot, and there were bugs all over the place, and two rebbeim approached me and asked me how I was doing. If I was all settled in, if they could get me anything, maybe I forgot something in America. They were warm, they were caring, they invited me for Shabbos. Now, when a person feels that someone cares about them as a person, they were, and especially when that feeling comes from a Rav, so they respect that person and will want to speak to that person about their issues. In Rebbeim, in Eretz Yisrael, sorry, the Rebbeim care about the Talmidim not as Bnei Torah, but as Bnei Adam. And I think that distinction is often lacking in America. There's a story I'll never forget, and that was a boy in yeshiva who started learning in January. Until January, he did not step foot in the Beis Medrash. Baruch Hashem, he's a budding Talmud Chacham now. He did not start learning until January. And Rav Wagner, who's the Mashkiach of the Yeshiva, who had a tremendous impact on myself and really hundreds upon hundreds of Talmidim, he went back to America for the interview process at the American high schools. And he came back, this Talmud was a huge football fan, and especially the New York Jets. And Rav Wagner came back, and he brought for him the most recent Sports Illustrated issue, because the New York Jets were the feature of the issue on the cover. Now, Rav Wagner clearly was not advocating for this Talmud to leave afternoon Seder and read Sports Illustrated. Rav Wagner, though, was able to tap into his personality to realize that this child had interests, and he cared about him as a person, again, not as necessarily the Ben Torah, but as the Ben Adam. And once the kid felt that the Rav cared about him as a person, so he spoke to him. And in Eretz Yisrael, when kids are deciding such major issues as where to go to college and what the proper Derech HaTorah is and what path to take in life, so they speak to their Rebbe because their Rebbe cares about them. Now again, I think a Rav of a shul has these opportunities. The problem is, I think most kids, they don't think of the rabbi of the shul as their rabbi. I think if you would go to shul and to any shul and point to the rabbi and ask a kid who is that, they will probably answer, that's my parents' rabbi, or that's the rabbi of the shul. They probably will not answer, that's my rabbi. And the kids don't feel that they have a relationship with their rabbi. A rabbi can have pizza with the 7th and 8th graders on a Thursday night, or basketball with the juniors and seniors on a Sunday. Not pizza and learning, or pizza and Torah. Just pizza, and schmoozing with kids about anything and everything that is of interest to them. A lot of time kids feel that the rabbi is trying to get them, and that they're trying to throw religion and spirituality at them. So if these programs would be run without, the focal point does not have to be Torah, at least initially, and bitulo hanu kiyumo sometimes, and kids will feel again that the Rav cares about them as people, and will eventually gravitate towards the Rebbeim and build relationships with them and speak to them about what's on their mind. When I started my hockey league with 180 kids, my purpose, at least initially, was not chinuch related, but now I can't go to TNEC without being bombarded by 7th graders who want to learn Torah. And I think the reason is because of the relationships that I was able to build with them outside of the Beis Medrash. And Mimela, the relationships in Torah and in Yiddishkeit come. Now, that's before Israel. Now, after Israel, so now everyone's speaking about how the kid comes back and he's quote-unquote flipped out. And he's too frum for his shul, and he's too stark for the shul rabbi. And as Rabbi Jacobson said, he becomes a chassan, and discussions begin about who's going to be Masada Kedushin. And the father says, well, our rabbi, my rabbi, who's been our rabbi for 20 years, he's going to be Masada Kedushin. There's no ifs, ands, and buts. And the Talmud, the chassan, says, well, my Rebbe in yeshiva, or my Rebbe in Israel, he's going to be Messiah Kedushin because he's my Rebbe. And the question is, how does this happen that all of a sudden the kid of, neglects his Rav of 22 years for his Rebbe of 3 years? What happened? So I think the answer is simple, in that the kid never felt that the Rabbi was his Rebbe. And it's not that he's all of a sudden neglecting his Rabbi. He never felt that the Rabbi was his Rebbe. And he has a connection with his Rebbe because his Rebbe cares about him, and that's why he wants his Rebbe to be Messiah Kedushin. Now, if rabbis can build relationships with the kids from elementary school and high school and then maintain them while they're in Israel, so that these situations will be avoided. I think an average Shana Aleph or Shana Bet student would love to receive an email from his rabbi asking him how he's doing. Does he like learning Bekiyas or Be'in or Halacha or Tanakh? Or simply if he's had a chance to visit the other kids from the shul. Or what he does on his free time. Does he play in the football league? Is he involved or she involved in chesed projects? And again, this won't work if the rabbi didn't have anything to do with the kid in high school, elementary school. But if the rabbi had these relationships beforehand and maintains them while they're in Israel and strengthens them when they come back from Israel, so the kids won't want to leave their shul and won't want to dive in down the block in the shtiebel or in the kollel. And I think another problem when they come back is that they feel that their rabbi is almost inferior to their shir rebbe. Their shir rebbe delivers these masterful shirim of lamdas and pilpul, and the rabbi gives nice Shabbos drushas. He gives nice sermons. And the kids are too immature sometimes to realize that the rebbe and the rabbi are speaking to different people. And I think to combat this problem, so if serious lamdas or shirim were given to boys or girls back from Israel, so that would go a long way in solving that problem. Maybe once a month, giving out Mar Makomos the week before to give a shiuron in Yoni Sviras Omer or Tisha B'Av or Birchas HaTorah or shiurim in Hashkafa and Machshava, and the kids will want to come and they'll feel that the rabbi is their rebbe, or have a tish or a shal shudas or Malav HaMalka once a month. Not with guys and girls, because the guys aren't going to come, and those are important to have also, but they're different needs for different people at different stages in life. And if these events, these shiurim and tishes and malav malkas were created, so then the boys and girls, I think, back from Israel would feel that they have a relationship with their rabbi, and that their rabbi will be their rabbi. And additionally, I think that some talmidim could be given an opportunity to participate in the shul. To give, as Rav Sosevsky mentioned, to give shiurim, to be involved. I know every time, for the past few years at least, when I've gone back to my parents for Yontif, so Rav Prusansky has asked me to give shiurim in between Mincha Marv or before Mincha, or to speak at Tashkama Minyan when the rabbi or the assistant rabbi is out of town. And in turn, the kids will feel that they're part of the shul. It's not just their parents' shul, but it's their shul that they're active participants. Another problem when they come back is the tension that's often found between the kids and their parents. And a scenario will arise where Mark, let's say, goes to Israel after high school, and he comes back and now he's Moshe Tzvi. And his parents say, Mark, and he says, well, Moshe Tzvi, please. And they say, tomorrow we're all going to the movies, or we're going to the beach. And Mark says, well, I'm not going, that's us, or I can't go, it's Yahar Val Yavor. And the parents say, well, your whole life you've been going, and our whole family's going, and of course you're going. So now, Mark feels that he can't grow in that situation, and Mark's parents feel that Mark is telling them that they're doing the wrong thing, and that they raised him wrong, and the last 18 years of his life were never existed. Or David goes to Israel, and he comes back, and he refuses to daven in shul with his father. The mechitza is too low, and there's too much talking, and no one's yotzei their chiv tefil in that shul. And David's father says, well, I'm the president of the shul, and your father and your grandfather have been davening the shul for the last 50 years. And David says, well, I'm not davening there. You're not yotzei your chiv tefil in that minyan. So again, what does David do? He feels he can't grow in that situation. He's a 19-year-old, spiritually fragile student. Does kibud av v'aim override his own growth? And how do David's parents, how are they supposed to feel? How do they react in this situation? And situations like this happen very often for the majority of Shana Aleph and Shana Bet students. It could be an issue of skirts versus pants for girls, or Shana Bet, not Shana Bet, YU or another yeshiva versus secular college. And how does everyone react in these situations? What are they supposed to do? So I was speaking about this issue with a professor of mine, an Israeli, Dr. Scott Goldberg, and we came up with an idea that the rabbi can really get involved and really counsel the parents and the kids about these issues. And a month before, the kids come back from Israel, so the rabbi can meet with the parents, if not individually, if it's a larger shul, and collectively, but to meet with the parents and discuss with them the issues that are going to arise. What's going to happen when your kid comes back? What might happen when your kid comes back from Israel? And how are you supposed to deal with it? And when the kids come back, to meet with the kids and discuss with them how these situations are playing out. And if necessary, to meet with the kids and the parents together to maintain both the parent-child relationship as well as this kid feeling that he could grow in this situation. And again, this will only work if the rabbi built the relationships while they were young, maintained them while they're in Israel through emails, or if the rabbi is in Israel on a mission to visit the yeshivot and meet with the talmidim, take them out for dinner, or just to visit them and speak to them. The rabbi will be able to play a crucial role and exert a tremendous amount of influence on these situations, because very often the rebbeim in Israel, they don't know the parents. So they can't really get involved in these situations, but the rabbi, who has a relationship with both the parents, and hopefully the children also, so he can really shape these issues, and the kid again will feel that the rabbi is his rebbe, he will speak to him about issues, he will be part of the shul. Now I think if we could build these relationships and discuss with kids these issues, we can reach them before they go to Israel, and if we could continue these relationships, involve them in the shul, give them shiurim, maintain the relationships, then we'll be able to keep them in the shul once they come back.
I think you earned your place up here with your rebbeim, Saria. First, we have in writing thanks to all the speakers for the beautiful presentations and thought-provoking presentations. Start, if I could call on Rabbi Sefsky with a question for Rabbi Sefsky. The question is, should the Israeli Rosh Yeshiva become the post-Israel posek for his Talmud? And if so, when should he? And when should he defer to the shul rabbi on issues of Pesach? Rabbi?
Let me just answer the question through the following. I don't believe that the Rebbe or Rosh Yeshiva in Israel wants to or is expected to, would like to remain the posek for the student for the rest of his life. In other words, we give them an experience in Eretz Yisrael and that allows them to grow. And if they're serious, they know they have to ask serious questions and, you know, ask them when they're appropriate. As Sariel had mentioned, very, very often the strongest ties that these kids have developed, you know, spiritually, has come in Israel. And therefore it's the only natural, I know in our instance we have a Rosh Kolel, who's a very fine posek, who gets a constant flow of emails of shaylos. I think that's a natural process. But if the Rav, again, like, has built up a relationship, I think what Sariel's points were very, very well taken, there's no reason why we have to be like the spiritual strings or attachment once the student goes, you know, and leaves the environment of Israel. There's certainly very, very fine poskim in America, and there's no reason whatsoever why these people shouldn't be answering the shaylos.
One other question for Rabbi Sefsky.
Back from Yeshiva Israel, he sees this as compromise. Whereas the Rav realizes that he has to
Again, as we mentioned before, I think this the process you're describing would be greatly facilitated if, like Sariel had pointed out, if a very serious relationship has been developed between the rabbi and the student prior to Israel. If there's a respect and a relationship that I think the average student understands, and the rabbi's in a position to explain to the student, like what he confronts, you know, as far as a community and as far as the shul is concerned. Having been a pulpit rabbi myself for a few years, I'm very well aware of these issues. Again, like I said before, though, sometimes what happens is that, you know, in the two most crucial years of the student's life, he's had people that he's approached, and you know, for psak, and therefore, like, he sees that this is the person who you know, he approaches in paskins. I do feel that perhaps, you know, it is something that we talk about a lot, about when you come back, you know, that it's not such a simple process, and you have to realize you're going back to community, and a community that's nurtured you. But again, kids at the age of 17 or 18, you know, obviously it's not the age where they, you know, where they really understand, like, what a role of a rabbi or a shashiva is. They're just all excited and just go along with the flow. But I think if the process of the relationship were developed early and continued, there's no question the rabbi would be in a position to have the student understand that very, very well.
Another question for Rabbi Sefsky. An issue that's been very much in the news, Jewish Week, other places recently, and an issue that I think shul rabbis hear about a lot, especially from parents in the community, is that students come back, both boys and girls, with very different perspectives on dating and marriage than they had prior to going. And some of the ideas they come back with seem to be contributing to a crisis of sorts in terms of children, young men and young women having difficulty finding shidduchim. Wondering whether any of that is discussed in yeshiva in Israel, and what you think from the perspective of the Israeli yeshiva could be communicated to your students about interactions with members of the other sex in relation to this issue.
I have to admit I'm a little confused exactly what the nature of the question is. In other words, what the... Yeah.
Young men and young women are given very blanket statements like, you should never talk to boys, you should never talk to girls, unless you're ready, you know, next week to get married. Something, I'm being exaggerated, but things of that nature, where what was normal social interactions are very much circumscribed, even beyond what we might believe, or what many of the people in this room believe is halakhically mandated.
Again, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for other institutions. But there's no question that by us, these things are spoken of. They're not spoken of in a formal context necessarily. They're spoken of informally with the students. And my personal feeling is, just as a matter of practicality, that the age of 17 and 18 is not necessarily the best time to get involved in a very serious relationship with the opposite sex, for very, very many reasons, right? On the other hand, very, very often students do come having, you know, girls that they have met previously, and where there is a relationship of sorts. And I know I spent a tremendous, tremendous of personal time, like, trying to counsel them how to work out that relationship. In other words, just, you know, off the cuff, what I think the key points is that if the relationship has potential of being a serious one, it can't be, like, totally open-ended. In other words, the student has to understand that if it's a serious relationship, let's say within 2 years they should be able to plan, or 3 years they should be able to plan to get married, and for becoming engaged in the interim, where it at least, you know, gives a little direction to a relationship that's very, very difficult to maintain. My own experience is that I've been personally Masada Kedushin at a lot of these, with a lot of these couples who, Baruch Hashem, have developed like really very, very wonderful families that we're all very, very proud of. It's an area that I think is extremely, extremely important. Obviously, I don't think that the answers are so simple. If a relationship doesn't exist, as I mentioned before, I don't necessarily think that that it's the best time to develop a serious relationship or to look for one. But there's no question that kids involved, you know, in NCSY are encouraged by us to continue in NCSY. We have many people that we have one or two actually regional directors. And, you know, I'm not talking about a kid coming out of a right-wing yeshiva. There, it's unnatural for him to talk to girls. But this is part of the process of modern Orthodoxy, and I don't think they should give that up, or necessarily they have to. They have to realize that they have a responsibility to keep the relationship in a framework where they can grow and develop.
Rabbi Schiller, you spoke of the problems that students have relating to the quote-unquote not explicitly sacred when they return. Wondering if you have any thoughts and practical suggestions about what can be done to ameliorate their relating to the not explicitly sacred, both in yeshiva and Israel, and also upon their return.
Well, I think that in general, not much time is spent in our high school institutions and in Eretz Yisrael as well in expressing the perspective which, for lack of a better term, has been referred to as Torim Derech Eretz or Torah Mada. Not much time is spent explaining exactly what it is that we do when we provide a large and expansive secular curriculum, when we provide extracurricular activities and sports and the arts and so forth. These things are just given and assumed to be part of normal existence. Now, when the young fellow or young lady gets to Eretz Yisrael and finds out that b'chol derechecha de'ehu, then the question becomes, where does all this fit in the God's plan for our salvation? And I think that if that issue was addressed, both in the pre-Eretz Yisrael experience as well as in Eretz Yisrael, it would go a long way to addressing this question. Of course, the problem is twofold in that. Number one is that, as Sariel pointed out, when you're dealing with a student body that is struggling still with Judaism 101 here in America, it becomes difficult to deal with these subtopics because the basics are not yet clear. That's one of the problems you confront in presenting these perspectives here in America. In Eretz Yisrael, to a large extent, a perspective known as Chardal has come to a large extent to dominate the scene, particularly in terms of mechanchim in Eretz Yisrael, so that although they may be where we want them to be and other issues, but when it comes to the issue of the non-explicitly sacred, many of the mechanchim in Eretz Yisrael might not be particularly where those who are in these camps want them to be. So I think those are the two issues we have to confront. But b'kitzur, there has to be more time invested, I think, here in America in explaining why it is that we do what we do. Is it a compromise? Is it something that God wants? Is it something God indulges? This is not really treated very seriously in our schools. We just offer them normal life full of the not explicitly sacred. It has to be engaged in a more serious manner.
Rabbi Schiller, both you and Rabbi Stefsky spoke of some of the problems with yeshiva high school education in the United States. The question is, given the different contexts in which these students are learning in the United States versus in Israel, how feasible is it really to expect so much of the educators in the United States? In what way can things happen here that may not be happening, and to what extent are there things that really we do have to rely on the year in Israel?
Well, I think an adequate response to that question would require a whole session in its own right, if not a year's worth of sessions. I feel very strongly that a great deal could be accomplished here in America, a great deal more than is accomplished here in America, and that it requires a combination of intelligence and idealism. The fact that that chinuch is a difficult field, in fact, the rebbeim are burdened financially, personally, makes it very difficult. The fact that people that get into the administrative role are often interested in preserving, and let's be blunt, they're interested in preserving the relative financial success that being an administrator brings them, and they're therefore not necessarily courageous enough to tackle thorny issues, makes this all very difficult. But Bekitzer, what I think is needed is attention to the problem, and attention to the problem is sorely lacking. There's an acceptance of things the way they are, and the rule of thumb, I think, should be to measure the standards of our high school students against the minimal standards of Shulchan Aruch, and to measure the successes in terms of learning and davening and mitzvahs. And again, I don't, as one who fancies the schools of Torah and Derech Eretz and Torah Mad and so forth, I say what I'm going to say now with a great deal of sadness, but certainly to measure the degree of success that we have by the standards of those in the yeshivish and hasidish worlds that achieve a great deal more in terms of Yedias HaTorah and Shemiras HaMitzvos and so forth. What you need is a sense of urgency. And from the first time that I walked into YHSQ 27 years ago, that urgency becomes more and more absent the higher you go up in the educational hierarchy. So again, I don't want to sound a negative note, but I think that it's very important to get people that are not going to tolerate the status quo, that are going to force the status quo into sincere firmkeit. And by, I don't mean in any means to compromise the basic assumptions of the modern Orthodox community in terms of secular studies and, as I said before, all these areas. But without compromising those assumptions, we, or unless we want to admit that what we're doing is necessarily inferior to that of the other schools. So I think a radical rejection of the status quo. When I first went to watch this 27 years ago, I asked a very highly placed person in modern Orthodox dom. I said, I just walked out of Kollel here, and I'm walking into a school in which basic halachas in every possible area of halacha are being ignored, and standards of learning are abysmally low. And I asked them, I said, what do we do about this? And I was 26 years old, and I went behind the ears, what did I know? And he said to me, well, the right has their problems too. And so I think we have to be done with that response, and we have to subject ourselves to painful scrutiny and act with courage.
Saria, a question related to something that I found often in interviewing students for my dissertation. One student coined the phrase the pause button to describe his experience and those of his friends in high school of essentially saying, I know I'm going to change when I get to Israel. Let me have my fun now, and I'll straighten it out when I get to Israel. What do you say to one of your hockey players who comes to you with this approach?
No one told me I was going to have to answer questions also. first of all, it's not... Kids think that it's magic. Going to Israel is magic. And it's not magic. Because if they're in, let's say, MTA, so the only people they see are the people who are in the Beis Medrash who, quote-unquote, made it. But it's not magic, and there are a lot of people who go to Israel who don't change, and who are now, you know, not the same, worse than they were when they were in high school. And really the important thing, though, is that you have to express to the kids the importance of now. Kids don't understand the importance of now. Again, if it's important to do a mitzvah now, and if firmkeit really carries with it meaning and purpose, so they'll want to be firm now. And it's not, you can't just tell them, well, don't do what you want now because you'll change. Do it because you have to, because it's a mitzvah, so that doesn't work. If they're exposed to the beauty of mitzvah, so they'll naturally gravitate towards them, as opposed to just waiting until I go to Israel, and then I'll really feel like what I'm doing is wrong. They might feel what they're doing is wrong, but they don't feel that the right thing is the right thing. So I think if we could express that the right thing is the right thing.
We're just about out of time. I'd like just take a minute or two to close. First, by thanking the people who've helped make this happen. Rabbi Herring, Rabbi Alman, Rabbi Przanski, Rabbi Bixen, applaud your efforts, and I again hope this will be a part of the convention again in years to come. I also am of the hope that at the Shalvim organized convention day for educators that took place a few months ago, there was discussion of it not being just isolated groups that get together to meet, but creating some sort of ongoing forum of discussion surrounding the issue. As I've mentioned before, the Orthodox Caucus is addressing these issues as well on an ongoing basis. And also, I think at that forum, it was basically educators. At this forum, it is mostly shul rabbis, although also educators, chaplains, and others. But I hope and look forward to the opportunity of having the assorted groups have those gaps between them bridged so that we can all be tackling these issues together. And finally, I also hope that while a tremendous amount was covered today, and hope people will continue the discussions over dinner, at the same time, there's as much that has not been discussed, and specifically, there are some issues that have not been addressed that I hope will be addressed in individual discussion and in upcoming conventions. Number one is the issue of girls. We here are very boy-heavy on our panel. I don't mean the people who are here, but the people in terms of who these rebbeim are dealing with are boys. Secondly, psychological issues that come up before and after the year in Israel. More about the role of the community rabbi, which we've touched on today. And finally, as also Sariel just alluded to a moment ago, the fact that the year in Israel is not magic, and there are many people who do not have at all the experience that we've talked about today, and to try to understand how that is, why that is, and what we can do to improve the experience for those people. I thank you very much, and have a good dinner.